From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And for the month of August, Latino USA celebrates 20 years. With a dip back into our archives, we begin with George Lopez talking about his first primetime show in 2003.
TV remembers things that are cutting edge and that are interesting. And you know what? Nice doesn't cut it anymore.
And in 1997, the then unknown writer Juno Diaz talked about representing for his home state as much as for his home country.
People could have spent all their time talking about New Jersey and say he is the voice of New Jersey. But instead, they say he's the voice of the Dominican people.
And what's changed in our conversation about immigration reform over the past 20 years? Can you tell whose voice this is?
I think it's easy to say, in theory, we're going to deport 11 million people.
All this and more coming up on this special archive edition of Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For the next month, we'll be taking you back through some Latino USA history. Because believe it or not, people, we've been on the air for 20 years. So we'll hear from presidents and actors, writers and musicians. And we'll start with a comedian. When The George Lopez Show came out in the year 2003, it wasn't an immediate hit. But Lopez played with Latino stereotypes in realistic and sometimes harsh ways. The abuela was a bruja. The daughter didn't look Latina. And in representing Latinos, Lopez wasn't afraid to show a little bit of ugly. Here's our conversation with George Lopez from the year 2003.
Oh! Under your arms, Carmen, you got jungle pits.
See, that's why I hate swim class. Everyone makes fun of me.
You know, when I was a kid, I got made fun of a lot, too. You're stupid. You're fat. Your father's a loser. Your grandmother can be a very cool woman.
Created as a mid-season replacement, The George Lopez Show now airs Wednesday evenings and has so far received mostly favorable reviews. George Lopez joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome to Latino USA, George.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're a stand-up comic, and suddenly you find yourself in a sitcom.
Uh-huh.
A little strange for you?
You know, it's not strange because as a creator of the sitcom, we kept it pretty close to my real life. So I actually feel kind of comfortable in that character and in the setting. You know, my grandmother who raised me, his name is Benny. My mother on the show's name is Benny. I had a best friend named Ernie and my wife is named Anne, but we made my wife Angie. So I actually feel very familiar.
So here was something that I didn't get. Your mother on the show, she's not nice at all.
Well, you know what? The glass is half empty or half full. You know, my abuelita and my mom were both people who weren't very nice. So when those other people who had nice parents do their own show, they can make their parents nice. But the fact that I made this close to my life, I had to make them real. I wasn't going to make them sweet because it's TV. You know, TV remembers things that are cutting edge and that are interesting. And you know what? Nice doesn't cut it anymore.
You know, I found it interesting that your daughter in the show doesn't look, quote, unquote, Latina, you know, because we all look so different. But I like the fact that if you see this kid on the street, you're not going to say, oh, she's Latina.
Well, you know what? That thank you for that, because I think you're the first person in the 100 interviews that I've done that's mentioned that. You know, we are everything.
Yeah.
You're going to make us all late for work.
Mom, wait.
George, you're not leaving. She lied to get out of swim class. Carmen, we're dealing with this now.
Look, Angie, is it that big a deal? Why does she need to know how to swim? We're already here.
George, that's not the point. She lied.
They lied because they're not afraid of you.
Benny, we're handling this.
I don't see anybody getting hit.
We don't hit our kids, Benny. We threaten to send them to your house.
Hey!
You know, there has been an email that's circulating now of people who should write in to the network and tell them to keep your show going since there's only a month of programming. Do you know about that? What do you think about that? Do you think it's going to have an impact?
Well, you know what? I'm in favor of that because What happens is that people think that we're invisible. And one of the reasons why executives from all the networks have gotten away with not casting Latinos is because we are, incredible number of people, but they don't really hear from us.
Well, what about if people don't like what you're doing? Do you think they should still be sending that letter if they're Latinos?
Here's the thing. If they don't like the show, then absolutely. Hey, we live in America. And if you don't like the show, I've read some emails that said that, I wasn't funny and that the show wasn't funny. And I've read some reviews that said that. But you know what? That's fine. Because what do we have if not our own opinions? The fact that I'm fortunate enough after 20 years of doing stand-up to have my own show and have it named after me, I feel no pressure from any Latino community. They've been very supportive. And the people that haven't, I respect that too. But I don't feel any pressure from ABC. They've been great. And Warner Brothers has been great. And you know what? This is the opportunity that I wanted. And I'm not going to put fear. I have no fear. As a comedian, I'm fearless. So I have no fear. And if it goes away, you know what? I was doing pretty well before. Look, having 10 million people watch you 2 weeks in a row, there are a lot worse things than that.
No kidding. Well, good luck with everything, George.
All right. I'm sorry to make you laugh, but,
No, you made me laugh.
Maybe next time.
Thanks a lot. We've been speaking with comedian and actor George Lopez. George Lopez is currently working on a new TV show called St. George that's coming soon on the FX network. Before most people knew what merengue or bachata were, before you knew that going to the DR meant you were going to the Dominican Republic, way before he was a Pulitzer Prize winner, we talked with author Juno Diaz. Just this week, we asked Juno Diaz what his interviews on Latino USA have meant for him, and he said Latino USA is a voice, a beacon, a classroom, and a conversation, one of the most important resources we have as a community. And for me as an artist, he said, it's a godsend. Well, thanks, Juno. And here we have Juno Diaz, the author as a young man, speaking to Latino USA in 1997.
Dia came out then with an apron on and maybe the longest Lee press-on nails I'd ever seen in my life. She gave everybody kisses, told me and Rafa how guapo we were. Rafa, of course, believed.
When Juno Diaz's stories were first published in literary journals and in The New Yorker last year, the 28-year-old Dominican-American author was instantly called the literary discovery of the year. Diaz is the author of Drown, a collection of short stories about the experiences of a boy whose family moves from Santo Domingo to a gritty Latino barrio of urban New Jersey.
The place had been furnished in contemporary Dominican tacky. The less I saw, the better. I mean, I like plastic sofa covers, but Dio and Tia had taken it to another level. They had a disco ball hanging in the living room and the type of stucco ceiling that looked like stalactite heaven.
Writer Juno Diaz now joins us on Latino USA. Juno Diaz, how does it feel to be called the voice of a people?
When people say it, they must be laughing as hard as I am when I hear it, because that's so ludicrous. I mean, you mentioned a book that I had just put down in my bag, and it's a book about New Jersey. And what's interesting is that, in one hand, the book that I wrote is no less about New Jersey. And yet, the thing which everyone focuses on the most is my Dominicanness, which is essential to who I am. But at the same time, it's kind of arbitrary, because people could have spent all their time talking about New Jersey and say, he is the voice of New Jersey. But instead, they say he's the voice of the Dominican people. And again, it's hilariously arbitrary and moronic. I mean, anytime I hear that, I tend to smash down hard on it because it's a bad idea.
So when you've been talking to people about your writing, sometimes some journalists and even some literary folks have believed that this book is about you. You don't like that.
God, what can you say? Like, I just feel, it's like that old saw. I mean, I feel like it's the battle back and forth, you know? We're always responsible, Black and Latino writers and, Native American writers and, Indian writers and, like, Asian American writers. We're always so responsible to autobiography. That's, like, the case, you know? Like, everybody's always like, well, how real is this? Because for most people, this is a voyeuristic enterprise when they read a book like this. You know, when I wrote it, it wasn't voyeurism. And when You know, my friends read it. It wasn't voyeurism. They didn't see anything unusual. They were Puerto Rican and Dominican, and they grew up in this neighborhood. And so for them, they just saw it as fiction.
The country where you were born and raised, the Dominican Republic, which I have visited on many, many, many occasions, to me is the ultimate experience in magical realism. Anything can happen, and anything can happen in a story, and you never know if it's true or if it's not true, or if it's just the person who's saying it and they're just embellishing it, because there's not much else to do on a hot afternoon but to hear and tell stories. And I'm wondering, when you think back, was that part of your influence in the storytelling, or was it really something that you came in touch with here in this country?
It was strange, because I think the stories that I remember from Santo Domingo were very sharp and very clear, and there was nothing fantastic about any of them. They all seemed extremely pressing and exigent. They seemed like right there, you know. I think what happened was, in the United States, I learned something about the way memory works. Because when I kept going back to Santo Domingo, you know, I began to have to reference these memories I had of my childhood with what I was seeing.
And when you first went back, what was the experience like?
You know, there's a number of very par reactions where it's like, oh, I went back and I didn't feel like I belonged. Oh, it was terrible. Or these other reactions where people are like, yes, I went back and everybody loved me and I really fit in. And I didn't get either of those. I was very comfortable. Again, I was raised in a very poor barrio for like the formative years. My deep structures were set, you know, in this place. So I went back and it was no sweat. But on the other hand, I knew my position. I knew exactly who I was. You know, I didn't think everybody was my friend. I didn't think that my community would accept me automatically. This is from a story called How to Date a Brown Girl, Black Girl, White Girl, or Halfie. Get back inside. Call her house, and when her father picks up, ask if she's there. He'll ask, who is this? Hang up. He sounds like a principal or a police chief, the sort of dude with a big neck who never has to watch his back. Sit and wait. By the time your stomach's ready to give out on you, a Honda or maybe a Jeep pulls in, and out she comes. Look, she'll say, my mom wants to meet
There's
you.
A lot of issues about sexuality and kind of coming to terms with the character in the book. And you recently wrote a piece for a magazine, a Latina magazine, about the issue of infidelity.
Right.
And I'm wondering, why is that an issue for you?
I feel like the way that infidelity got talked about, at least in the community I grew up, or at least from what I saw, is that there tends to be like this really simple way of talking about it, which is, you know, if you watch any shows or you hear people talking about it, people be like, yo, men are dogs. Or they get to say, nah, man, it's about this, this, and that. And it just seemed like the reactions were all really pat. And for me, I always want to get in somewhere and really like kick something around. You know, people are actually uncomfortable about talking in a different way. People prefer to maintain their old battle lines. You know, I would get letters where people were just like furious. They were like mad. It's almost as if I had kept my mouth shut, it would have been okay. And I just see the way like, yo, man, like just the way we are. It's unbelievable across the races, you know, and people don't want to see around these issues or talk about it. And the way it affects children is what really interests me. Because, you know, infidelity is kind of boring. We've been doing it forever, like blah, blah, blah. But then the element of children, like how it really does affect children. Like children know.
They do. Thanks very much for speaking to us on Latino USA.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Juno Diaz lives in New York. He's the author of the book Drown, published by Riverhead Books. Coming up on Latino USA.
We also have to get people in every community in a position where they're working together and speaking with each other honestly across racial lines.
Reflections on racial divisions 20 years ago from then-President Bill Clinton on Latino USA's first ever presidential interview. That's coming up. No se vayan.
Yo, estos son los empresarios.
Hay que tener cautela.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So, do you hear the Chicago in this guy?
Oh, I disagree with that completely. I mean, think about it.
That's Barack Obama, back from when he was just a senator from Illinois. Obama spoke to us in the year 2006. Back then, not unlike today, Congress was considering immigration reform. And a little note, listen to the then-senator's critiques of the fear around deportation policies, policies that he, as president, has been unable to change. Here's Senator Barack Obama in the year 2006.
Welcome to Latino USA, Senator.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, an interesting couple of weeks, would you say?
Oh, well, you know, the debate around immigration obviously has really heated up. The enormous show of support for a comprehensive reform, first in Chicago, my hometown, where we had over 100,000 people spreading across the country, 500,000 in Los Angeles, I think awakened Congress to the enormous passion that's out there on this issue.
It's not as if the Democrats are seizing on this moment to say, we have a solution and we're the party that represents you. Would you agree, Senator?
Oh, I disagree with that completely. I mean, think about it. You know, we have been the moving force in terms of even making the possibility of earned citizenship possible. I think the Republican bill is reflected in what came out of the House with Sensenbrenner, which basically criminalized not only undocumented workers, but criminalized anybody who provided them any aid whatsoever. If you look at the current bill that's before the Senate, it contains earned citizenship for the 11 to 12 million who are here. It provides for a guest worker program.
Senator Obama, you are the son of an African immigrant. I wonder, would you, if you could have, would you have gone to that Chicago demonstration where over 100,000 immigrants poured into downtown Chicago? And also, do you think that these protests really have had an impact on legislators? Because there are many people who think that street protests will just never change anything.
Oh, no, I think it had an enormous impact. I certainly would have been there. Many of my friends were some of the organizers of those demonstrations. I just had to make a speech here in Washington, and so wasn't in Chicago. Because I think anytime you personalize the plight of undocumented workers, the American people's natural common sense, practicality, and compassion come forward. I think it's easy to say, in theory, we're going to deport 11 million people. I think it's much harder to expect police officers to grab fathers from their children and unilaterally send them across the border. I don't think it's realistic in terms of the resources that we have, or that's the kind of face of America that we want to see.
Thank you, Senator Barack Obama.
It was my pleasure.
That's Barack Obama, back from when he was a senator from Illinois. Obama spoke to us in the year 2006. As the Latino USA team has been poring over our massive archives, one thing has come up a lot. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Recently, after the events surrounding the death of Trayvon Martin, there have been calls for a national dialogue on race. Unfortunately, we've heard this call before. 20 years ago, from then-President Bill Clinton. I spoke with him in 1993 to discuss, among other things, Clinton's efforts to convene a conversation on race in America.
Mr. President, thank you for speaking with us on Latino USA, and I want to start off first by asking you this. Many Americans who feel very strongly about the issue of race have applauded your decision to make an important speech, but there's been much criticism of your administration because your policies have not been as effective as they would have liked. What direct action do you propose to make people believe that something different is going to happen now?
If you look at the appointments I've made to the administration, to the federal bench, if the policies I've followed to try to help reward the working poor, move people from welfare to work, increase the availability of education, and get economic opportunity into isolated areas, I think that these are the things we have to do more of in terms of policies. But beyond policies and beyond the strict enforcement of the civil rights laws, we also have to get people in every community in a position where they're working together and speaking with each other honestly across racial lines.
What would you recommend that they say to start talking to each other?
Well, first of all, I would recommend that they be honest while being respectful, and I think it's possible to do both. I think, you know, in communities where there are tensions between residents and merchants, between police and residents, between people of different ethnic groups sharing the same schools or workplaces, I think there has to be some format. People have to go to a leader of a religious leader, a community leader, someone who can convene a meeting, and then they need to be really honest with each other.
Over the last several years, Mr. President, not only have Latino immigrants, but Latinos who were born in this country have increasingly felt under attack from those who would blame immigrants for many of this country's problems. And what will you do in this next year to address and alleviate this?
Let me just say, we got to puncture a lot of myths in the minds of the rest of America about Hispanic Americans and immigrants generally. But let's just take the Hispanics. Two-thirds of all Latinos are born in America who live here today. And most of those who are immigrants were not undocumented. They came here legally. Last year alone, over 150,000 Latinos came to America as legal immigrants. And finally, every single study has shown that virtually all immigrants come here, work hard, pay taxes, and make a greater contribution to the American economy than they take out in tax dollars. Now, that does not mean that we shouldn't have laws against illegal immigration. That does not mean we should tolerate the violation of our immigration laws. But it does mean that Latinos are entitled to the presumption of good citizenship and honesty and to the same respect every other group of Americans are entitled to.
Thank you so much for speaking with us, Mr. President. Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you very much.
After listening to all of these pieces from our archive, myself and the staff here at Latino USA realized that in 20 years, many of our country's problems related to race, class, and inequality have not been solved. So I'm taking this moment to say that on this show, we're rededicating ourselves to covering these important issues and to discussing them thoughtfully, fearlessly, and with compassion. Here's to the next 20 years of Latino USA. And for this week, that's our show. Become our amigos or our friends. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And we're also on Tumblr. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Diana Montaño, Miguel Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. Poetryfoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to help reverse childhood obesity at rwjf.org. This is NPR.